KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu.
From KCRW in Santa Monica and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
If you listen and learn, then you're going to be able to do anything you want in this town.
Everybody thinks show business is really all white life. He doesn't crazy.
What's with him?
Oh, I'm afraid he's gone Hollywood.
This week on The Business, a new musical collaboration from pop star Ben Folds, popular novelist Nick Hornby, and William Shatner. Plus, we check out those star maps that point out houses of the rich and famous. And what can we learn about today's shrinking A-list from a book about one of yesterday's biggest stars? But first, it's the Hollywood News Banter. Stay close. It's The Business from KCRW.
You can imagine Hollywood, everything is really driven by
making money.
What's with him?
Oh, I'm afraid he's gone to Hollywood.
I'm joined in the studio by my fellow banterer, John Horn of the Los Angeles Times. John, how's it going?
It's going very well. Happy Valentine's Day.
Oh, almost. Thank you. It's almost romantic. So, John, I believe I'm going to have to eat a little dish of crow because... I think I had predicted on the air that the Academy would drop having 10 nominees, and now we've seen the result. And I have to say, it's not bad.
It's not bad. I think maybe next year we'll have 20. Everybody's in.
I mean, we all know who the top five are. And then we have the others, two commercial ones, Blindside and District 9. And Up, which I think may have been the fifth one, although maybe not. And then there were two non-commercial ones, and Education, and they're really kind of curveball, Serious Man, which is, of course, a very weird movie.
Yeah, but remember, the Coen brothers won the Best Picture a couple of years ago with No Country. So a little weird for a kind of a smaller out there movie, but... You also know that they have a lot of fans and followers in the Academy.
But I guess the bottom line from my point of view is, maybe it's just a fluke of this year, but they actually managed to have it not be completely embarrassing and potentially helpful.
It seems to be in some ways, a pretty representative slice of the best movies. There are a lot of people, though, including you, I know, who are unhappy that The Hangover didn't make the short list.
I was devastated. Okay, now speaking of Valentine's Day, which we were a moment ago, the parties in the NBC Universal Comcast merger testified before Congress last week and promised that everything will be fine.
My favorite line was from Al Franken, who, having worked at NBC in the Saturday Night Live years, said to the Comcast NBC brass, "You'll have to excuse me if I don't trust these promises." I think, and I think he was looking back at something that happened years ago when the financials. Interest syndication rules were lifted and the companies all said independent producers will still flourish, everything will be great, and now almost every independent television production company is gone.
Right. But now they're saying there will be no layoffs and there will be NBC will continue to broadcast. That was one of my favorite lines. Jeff Zucker saying, "Before this joint venture, I was concerned about the future of broadcasting." I would say he had reason to be.
If I was only watching his network,
yes,
I would have been concerned about the future
too.
Of broadcasting.
He said it's been under a tremendous amount of duress. He didn't add from me.
Exactly. As if that happened in a complete vacuum.
Yeah.
I mean, I think, the consumer groups who are nervous about this merger would say such centralized power would decrease not only competition but access. Will over-the-air free television go away? Is there a scenario where NBC could put let's just say hypothetically it had some hit shows where it put its hit shows on one of its cable networks and the free over-the-air stuff was reruns of The Price is Right. I mean, I think that's the concern, that they're going to put their quality programming or their popular programming on cable channels where they get more income, and then the network stuff will just be even crummier than it is now, if that's possible.
Now, meanwhile, we have a couple of auctions going on. Miramax on the block and MGM looking for somebody to buy. Who will buy? What do you think, John?
Well, I think the real issue is the timing. It would be somewhat akin to, say, you invented the gas pedal for the Toyota Camry trying to go public right now. It doesn't seem like the time is right.
Disappointing prices.
Well, and also you have to look at what's going on in the business. Movie Gallery, a huge 2,400-store video company, just filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy. The economics of Hollywood, especially what ancillary revenue these film libraries can spin off, have changed completely. And they go down by the hour, in fact.
And you're obviously talking about DVD sales and such like when we're in the dollar rental world. Of course, with Miramax, the interesting thing is whether the Weinstein brothers, who founded the company and named it after Mom and Dad, Miriam and Max, can actually pull off a purchase of their company and get their name back.
Well, maybe they could take all the profits from The Road and Nine and make it. Wait, that wouldn't work very well. I mean, obviously, Harvey and Bob would like to do that, but their company, you know, you keep thinking that it's going to be any day now that they either go away or have to recapitalize completely. I just don't see that happening. I see one of the bigger companies like Summit probably getting Miramax, but probably at a much smaller price than Disney thinks it's worth.
Yes, the herd seems to be thinning, and we'll probably have more of that action in the months ahead. And I believe that is all the banter we have time for, John.
Kim, a pleasure as always.
John Horn of the Los Angeles Times. A couple of weeks ago, novelist Nick Hornby came by to tell us why he'd chosen not to write the screenplays for the movies based on his popular books, like About a Boy, and why he then turned around and adapted Lynn Barber's memoir, An Education, for the screen. The simple answer is that after he's written a book, he's just done with it. And it seems like he knew what he was doing because his screenplay for An Education was just nominated for an Oscar last week. Now, if you're a fan of Hornby or the movies that are based on his books, you might have noticed that Hornby is also really into music, as he told our producer, Matt Holzman.
A few years ago, I wrote a book called Songbook, which was essays about songs, and I wrote an essay about Ben Folds, who's somebody I admire very much. And because I was sucking up to him in this essay, he got in touch to say how wise he thought the essay was.
He, by the way, of Ben Folds, Ben Folds Five,
right? Yeah.
Okay, very popular band.
And we stayed in touch by email, and then about 3 or 4 years ago, he asked me if I wanted to write a song for William Shatner for this album that he was doing. And how could one resist an invitation like that? So I wrote a lyric for William Shatner, and that appeared on the album Has Been that Ben made with him. And then I think 2 years ago, Ben said, do you want to try for a whole album's worth with me? And so I just started writing things that I thought looked like lyrics.
Had you written songs before?
No, the Shatner thing was the first time I'd ever done it. And so there were various ideas I'd had, you know, mostly that I was thinking of maybe for short stories. And so I started to try and write them in lyric form and just email them to Ben. And he started sending these MP3s back, and it all got a bit out of hand, really, and now there are orchestras and things involved, but it's, you know, it's fantastic fun. And logging on in the morning, picking up my emails, and if suddenly the email clogs up and it goes really, really slow, I know it's a new song from Ben Folds. So it's a great way to start the day.
It really must be very different. When you write your book, it gets printed, it comes back to you, it's still the same words that you wrote.
Yeah.
You're involved in a movie, it's a complete kind of morphing of your work into something else, and the music too. And lyric and a song are two very different things.
Yeah, I think the music's really different because it looks like I think what you realize is that songs are about the music. I don't think you can have a great song which has bad music. I think you can have a great song that has bad words. And I think some of the greatest songs ever recorded, when you look at the lyrics written down, you wouldn't necessarily guess that they had immortality thrust upon them. So I feel that the words have to have something going on in terms of a narrative or a character. So the songs are of a certain kind. They are short stories mostly.
Has he changed any of your lyrics?
No, but that, I think he made that one of the disciplines of it, that whatever he got, then he used that. And sometimes he can't write the music for them, and that's been interesting. He he just says, I think this lyric is great. Nothing comes to mind whatsoever. And sometimes he says, I think this lyric is great. Here's the melody for it. I think he has such an amazing facility with melody. It just really comes out of him.
Has he ever said to you, I'm not going to change this, but if this had two less syllables, it would make it much easier?
Yeah, he's done that. He's done that. And he said, you know, there are two words missing from the chorus. And I said, no, that's really fine, Ben, if that's what you needed to do. But he's very respectful of them and always he doesn't sort of willfully mess them up at all. And I'd say we've got probably 9 or 10 decent songs so far. So we're really on the last leg. And I think the album's coming out in the spring.
Here's a bit of the song that Ben Folds and Nick Hornby wrote for William Shatner's album, Has Been. It's called That's Me Trying.
That's me trying.
He's still working in that store in Ventura? He's still going with... No, that's not fair. I know I haven't been the very best of dads. I'll hold my hand up there. But the reason that I'm writing is I'd like for us to meet. Get a little daughter-dad action going soon. We could put things behind us, eat some pizza, drink some beer.
Entertainment is, unsurprisingly, LA's major export. And largely because of that, the city's major import is tourists. They spend an estimated $13 billion a year in the city, and an awful lot of that is thanks to the lure of celebrity. We're not sure whether that $13 billion estimate includes money spent on an unofficial tourist attraction, the Star Map. People have been dying to catch a glimpse of the domiciles of the rich and famous since the 1920s. In those days, the big attraction was Pickfair, the Bel Air mansion of Douglas Fairbanks and Mary Pickford. Now in the age of Us Weekly and TMZ, interest has only grown. Alex Schmidt has more.
If you grew up in Los Angeles like I did, you got used to seeing those signs that say maps to stars' homes along the fanciest parts of Sunset Boulevard. But if you think about it, it's actually a strange sight. Folks plop down in lawn chairs in front of these extravagant mansions with ratty hand-painted signs. It never occurred to me to stop until this past Christmas. During prime tourist season, I decided to become one myself.
Jessica Alba, Christina Aguilera, Jennifer Aniston, David Beckham.
Joaquin Delgadillo is a 40-ish man from Mexico wearing a Santa hat. He sells star maps from a tiny corner of sidewalk just down the street from the Playboy Mansion. Joaquin has a license from the city, but he has to stay on a tiny sliver of curb that's designated as public property.
How much are the maps?
I sell this one for $10 and I get the $5 for me. Sometimes I sell one, and sometimes I don't sell anything.
What was your best day ever?
Last summer, I sold 35 maps, and I made a little money.
Jesus, big piece of paper.
The map says Movie Star Homes in red across the front, and inside it shows Beverly Hills and Hollywood on a grid. There's a list of celebrities in their place on the grid. C3 is Steve Martin, C11 is Lindsay Lohan's former house, so noted by a pound sign next to her name. There's an asterisk next to George Burns and Carol Lombard, meaning they've gone to their mansions in the sky.
We've got Courtney Cox, Simon Cowell, Cher, Phil Collins, Tom Cruise, and Katie Holmes. Charo! I want to go to Charo's house. That's it. Done.
Before I could even start on my search for the Coochie Coochie Girl, a guard from a nearby mansion walked up to my window and shooed me away. The cities of LA and Beverly Hills may love the dollars tourism brings in, but the neighbors aren't always as thrilled. A 5-minute drive through tree-lined streets led me to a black and white hacienda-style mansion on a corner lot. Surrounded by an old white wall, it says La Paranda in fancy script on the wrought iron gate.
Okay, so, you know, I don't know. I don't know if I even buy it. Is the star map even accurate? How do I confirm that this is Charo's house? All right, I better not look in the mailbox when the tour bus is rolling by.
I am clearly not the only one around hunting for stars' homes. I've seen a number of people drive by with star maps, and tour buses are constantly going by. The city of Beverly Hills gets complaints about the amplified voices of the tour guides all the time, and they're considering requiring that the tour companies replace the speakers with headsets. Luckily for me, they haven't instituted that rule yet, and I was able to overhear a bit of what he was saying.
Wait, did he just say what Paranda means?
The party.
Paranda means party. Okay, thank you. Have fun.
The party, the guide said. And I thought, if he knows so much, maybe I should take a celebrity tour.
This is a two-hour fully narrated tour.
The epicenter of celebrity tourism is the Chinese theater once owned by showman Sid Grauman. There are around 20 or 30 tour companies right on Hollywood Boulevard near the theater. There's Amazing LA Tours, Beverly Hills Guideline Tours, All Los Angeles Tours, and Starline Tours. Klaus Ritter is head of marketing for Starline.
The company goes back all the way to 1935 when Bud Delp was his name. He was a driver, the chauffeur for Sid Grauman, who started the Chinese theater. And back in those days, 1935, the Depression and everything, they needed to make ends meet, so Bud came up with this idea that, you know, he could take people up to the Beverly Hills area, and this was a pretty good business for him.
Bud sold Starline to the current owners in the 60s. Today, it's one of the biggest tour companies in the business. Starline is known for its open-air double-decker buses, but it's raining today, and only the minivans are running. The Rose Bowl is just a couple days away, and our bus is packed with some serious Ohio State fans dressed in bright red and a quiet family from Australia.
Well, hi, everybody.
Hi.
My name is Brian. Everybody say hi, Brian.
Hi, Brian.
It's my favorite part of the whole tour. What's your name?
Brian Donnelly has been doing tours for more than a decade. The fast-talking man with the headset is arguably LA's most famous guide to the famous. He's been profiled in magazines and on TV, and his house is said to be filled with celebrity paraphernalia. But it's clear that Brian isn't just a fan of show business. He is show business.
Dynasty, Falcon Crest, Beautician and the Beast, The Golden Child, The Big Lebowski, The Fabulous Baker Boys, Clueless, Jumbo Jack Flash, MacGyver, Alderby, Nixon, Dark Shadows, The Gilmore Girls, The Loved One, The Disorderly Orderly.
Can I interrupt really quickly?
You surely may.
Are we going to see where Charo lives?
I can't believe you asked me that just as we were coming up here to talk about it. That, I think, is hysterical. This is Charo's house right here. This on your left-hand side, 1801 Lexington.
How do you know for sure that she lives there?
Other than the fact that I've seen her?
I guess you can't argue with that. But the truth is, we'd have a better chance of seeing a star at Starbucks. Many celebs' homes are hidden behind giant gates, like we saw Orlando Bloom's mailbox, but not his actual house. We did see the video cameras that were put there after a group of teenagers broke in, using celebrity websites to figure out when he wasn't home.
The two big palm trees in the front are called Canary Island Palms. They're worth $10,000 each. And on either side sticking out are two three-car garages, just one of them. Is bigger than the 800-square-foot home I'm renting in Burbank.
Considering how much free information about stars is now available on the web, it's amazing that these people even bother to take a tour. I mean, sure, we're seeing the front of Dr. Phil's Tuscan, but with Google Maps, you can see if he's sitting by his pool. 1008 Lexington Road. Try it. But Klaus Ritter of Starline told me that they still can book 600 or 700 people a day at around $40 a head during peak times like Christmas. After the tour, I asked Pam and Tim Schramm, a couple of Ohio Buckeyes fans, what they thought of the 2 hours we just spent with Brian Donnelly.
I guess I thought I would see a little more famous people than what I did, and I thought the homes would be a little more impressive, too. The driver was awesome.
And that, of course, is really what you're paying for on a star tour. Who knows? If Brian Donnelly keeps it up, maybe one day his place in Burbank will be one of the stops. For The Business, I'm Alex Schmidt.
You're listening to The Business from KCRW. We want to know what you think. Write us at thebusiness@kcrw.com or go to the comment page for today's show at kcrw.com/thebusiness. This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. Being a star ain't what it used to be. There are very few names now that are guaranteed to draw an audience to the theaters on an opening weekend. And because of that, even A-list stars find that their salaries are now negotiable. These days, the real stars are franchises and sequels. The power resides with J.J. Abrams and James Cameron. A new book looks at the days, not so long ago, mind you, when star power was everything. It's called Star: How Warren Beatty Seduced America. We asked author Peter Biskind to compare and contrast yesterday and today. You have written this book about Warren Beatty, and he is, we know that he slept with 12,000-something women. I'm sort of torn between being horrified and dissed that he never asked me. But, you know, Warren Beatty is an iconic, or was an iconic, movie star. Can you do that today? Can you be that, create that kind of legend around yourself?
Well, it's hard to answer that question. I mean, nobody has. I mean, there's no Warren Beatty today. Clooney is a big star, but you don't see him in the tabs escorting hundreds and hundreds of women here and there. Beatty had a certain glamour around him that I think even Clooney doesn't have.
But the question I guess I want to focus on is, how did he wielded this enormous influence over the studios. He got to call the shots on movies like Reds and movies like Dick Tracy over the years. How did that work, and can it be done now?
You know, I think there's a couple of explanations for that. First of all, he was an enormously successful star. He was a, you know, Tom Cruise plus at that time.
As a box office draw.
At the box office. I mean, when they put out, Warner Brothers put out, hated Bonnie and Clyde. When they put it out, they just dumped it. And Beatty just drove them crazy, agitated, relentlessly pursued them. He used to call them the mosquito because he would, you know, he was so relentless to re-release the movie. And then it became a huge hit. And I don't think anybody has ever done that before. And studios do not acknowledge mistakes. And if they put a film out and it flops, they don't re-release it. And then, you know, it's mud on their face. Plus, he had a deal which gave him 40% of the gross, so there was nothing, you know, they
40%.
Yeah,
they
weren't going to make anything on it, you know, so there was nothing in it for them, really, and plus that they had to admit that they'd been a terrible mistake, and that gave him enormous amount of authority. Then he went on to make Shampoo, which the studio didn't want to make, and that turned into a big hit. And then he went on to make Heaven Can Wait, which was even a bigger hit. Now, I think one thing that he was very good at and probably learned from a very well-known agent-turned-producer, Charlie Feldman, who was a mentor of his in the 60s, Beatty actually packaged himself. He would present a full package to the studio. He would have himself as the star, often himself as the director, and then he would cast all the other the major roles with his friends, you know, Julie Christie, Goldie Hawn, whatever, and then he would hire a screenwriter and write the script and then develop the script. And if the script wasn't good enough, he would hire someone to polish it. So he could come to the studio with a full package because he was so attractive as a bankable entity. He would be able to take the package, and if Warner Brothers didn't like it or they gave him a hard time, as they did with Heaven Can Wait, he would take it to Paramount. Or he always had another studio. He played that game with Shampoo. But another factor in this is that the studios were in such disarray, and there was such a turnover in the executive ranks at the studio at that time in the mid-70s, early mid-70s, that Beatty realized that, you know, that traditionally if they get a new head of production, they deep six all the projects that are in the pipeline, and they look for new stuff because they can put their stamp on it. So he made a specialty of appealing to new studio heads. He took advantage of that and played them off against each other.
Now, when Warren Beatty was at his peak, did he stand out as a star wielding that kind of clout, or was he one of many who had that kind of power?
No, he was pretty unique. I mean, anybody who gets Gulf and Western to finance a movie like Reds, you know, which, you know, a history of the U.S. Communist Party and the Russian Revolution.
High concept.
And the Russian Revolution with a storyline of a hero who dies at the end miserably, you know, in a poverty-stricken Soviet hospital. I don't think there was anybody but Beatty who could, A, do it, and B, wanted to do that.
And then versus now, how does that stack up?
Well, I don't think it's possible to do that now because the studios I mean, the star system is in some disarray, you know, with the financial difficulties that the country at large is facing. Studios are trying to roll back star salaries. Plus, you have Avatar with no stars in it, you know, setting records right and left. You know, the question is whether Avatar is a one-off or whether Avatar is going to change the business, I think. And I don't think it's going to. I think we'll sort of reach some middle ground where star salaries will be cut or different kinds of deals will be made. But that I don't think stars are ever going to become irrelevant.
You know? I mean, we've already seen the studios taking away 20% gross. I mean, mm-hmm. Sony just walked away from Spider-Man 4, which had mm-hmm. followed a sequel that grossed $890 million worldwide. And I think part of the reason was that 20% gross is no longer something they really want to pay to mm-hmm. talent. Mm-hmm. And we're seeing mm-hmm. the stars taking on more of the risk if the movie doesn't work.
I mean, this has been in the cards for years. I mean, ever since, you know, also with the Beatty movie, Katzenberg wrote his famous memo.
Jeffrey Katzenberg at the time was at Disney, running the Disney film studio, and wrote his memo about what was ailing the film business.
Right. And Dick Tracy had broken, you know, in those days, a big barrier, which is $100 million. It had grossed $100 million.
Well, only just.
Only just, but nevertheless, it had. However, the studio spent a fortune promoting it, not to mention the cost of making it. And I wouldn't say they considered it a failure, but they, you know, Katzenberg in his memo said he would never do it again.
And I guess we'll just to remind those who have forgotten or inform those who never knew, the Katzenberg memo was really saying a very basic and obvious fact, which is that content is king and that story is more important than bells and whistles, I guess, right?
Yeah, I think so. And the studios are spending too much money both making the movie, producing the movies, and publicizing the movies.
But, you know, I have to say, having been through when the Katzenberg memo stunned Hollywood, and I thought, what is so surprising about this memo? I think the most surprising thing was that he was willing to kind of insult Warren Beatty by saying that I spent too much on his movie.
Yes. I mean, I think that's true. I mean, you know, one could have imagined that memo without singling out Dick Tracy, you know, and the fact that why he did that, I have no idea. I mean, I don't know, you know, because he and Warren were very close.
Very close. Yeah.
And Warren was shocked, you know, and Katzenberg apparently, you know, launched a campaign to make up, you know, sending all sorts of gifts to Warren, which he threw in the wastebasket. And he was very angry about it, and especially after they had been so, you know, so close. And, you know, I think Warren had to protect himself against the image of somebody who went over budget. I mean, he'd just gone over budget, you know, on Ishtar, and just done, and that was a flop. And I think one of the reasons he did Dick Tracy instead of one of a million other projects he had in his personal pipeline was because he wanted to do a surefire hit. And then for Katzenberg to come out and say this was not a hit, even though it had grossed $100 million, was the last thing Warren wanted to hear.
Right, even though it may have been true. Peter Biskind is the author of numerous books about Hollywood, including Easy Rider's Raging Bulls, Down and Dirty Pictures, and Gods and Monsters. His latest book is Star, How Warren Beatty Seduced America. Thanks, Peter.
Thank you, Kim. It was a pleasure to be here.
And that's The Business. Matt Holzman produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. Darby Maloney is our associate producer. Our theme music, Mashup, was designed by beat architect Jason Grohman. The Business is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica. If you have any questions or comments about the show, write us at thebusiness@kcrw.com. You can also listen to this or any past program and comment about the show at kcrw.com/thebusiness. You can listen to a podcast, share it with a friend, or embed it on your blog with the click of a button from our new media player at kcrw.com. And you can always subscribe to the podcast through iTunes. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.
KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu.